Sign up to The Economist for in-depth curated expert analysis of world events and topics ranging from business and culture to science and technology. You'll get the weekly digital edition, online-only articles, curated newsletters on politics, the markets, science, culture and China, and full access to The Economist Podcast Plus. The Economist is independent journalism for independent thinking. Go to economist.com and get your first month free.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special.
Hello and welcome to The Culture Bunker, your weekly trawl through the depths of pop culture. I'm Sian Pattenden.
I'm Alex Andreu.
And I'm Andrew Harrison. This week, they're taking us over. We're delighted to be joined by Brett Anderson and Matt Osman of resurgent rock and roll noir institution Suede. They'll be talking about their upcoming new album, Auto Fiction, how it feels to return to the delinquent racket of their teenage years and life as music's most literate band.
Plus, who shot JRR? We'll be strapping on the swords and armor to take a look at Amazon's new adaptation of Lord of the Rings and having our say on the Game of Thrones prequel, House of the Dragon, now well into its run on Sky. Does anyone ever wear clothes in these pseudo-medieval worlds? Not complaining, just asking.
Plus, we have great new music and the greatest records of all time from our guests, Brett and Matt. All this and more on today's Culture Bunker.
When Suede first exploded onto a stagnant British music scene in the early 90s with hits like The Drowners, Metal Mickey and Animal Nitrate, they did so as a standing outrage. Pale thin men playing seedy songs of sexual misadventure over a swaggering glam racket. They owned possibly the final moment when an appearance on Top of the Pops could outrage your dad.
And since then, the Suedey boys, as we know them, have been concept artists and pop sensations. They've experienced commercial highs and the invariable lows you get too. They split up and reunited, and they've reinvented themselves as makers of widescreen cinematic art rock with excellent recent albums such as Night Thoughts and The Blue Hour.
Now they're back with their ninth album, a raucous record of back-to-basics punk rock called Auto Fiction, out on September the 16th. I'm going to talk to them after a taster from the album. This is an excerpt of She Still Leads Me On. Full track on the playlist, of course. Welcome to the podcast, Brett Anderson.
Well, thank you very much. Lovely to be here.
And returning guest, Matt Osman, who we had on a while ago. Welcome back.
Thank you very much for having me again.
So tell us, Matt and Brett, how does it feel to be back in the Suede saddle again? Because you've looked at life from both sides now.
Yeah, it's been amazing. You know, especially after the last couple of years, you know, I think we've always been a band that kind of thrived on kind of connection and community and kind of getting out there with the fans and stuff. The last 2 years have been kind of harder than I thought they would be, to be honest. And to be coming back with a record that I think has that kind of connection and is going to work really well in live gigs is, yeah, it's been really good.
Yeah, Brett, the band's live reputation is quite formidable. Did you find yourself withdrawing?
Yeah, I had a little bit of a personality kind of identity crisis. I kind of ended up wondering who I was. When I couldn't become the Brett Anderson from stage, it was odd. I never thought I'd actually miss being him. And somehow I felt sort of like a little bit a bit childish, kind of missing him, but I did miss him in the end. But now he's back again prancing away.
I mean, it is a very different record from the previous two. Night Thoughts and The Blue Owl were very ornate, very atmospheric. Songs bled and fed into one another. It was almost kind of dreamlike. This is heads down punk rock, isn't it?
It's our punk record. And that's an important distinction from saying it's a punk record. I don't think it's a punk record. I'm not really interested in ape in a genre like that. It's supposed to be like the kind of ethos of punk, the sort of scruffiness of it, the kind of lack of respect for yourself in a way that sort of fed through a suede lens almost. And we kind of, hopefully we've made it our own version of punk. But yeah, lots of the influences of punk and post-punk, you know, Pistols are always there for us. Pearl and things like that and the Banshees and stuff like that are definitely in there. And I think you can hear it a lot in Richard's guitar playing. Richard's really owned this record and it's been brilliant for him.
Also, you developed a bit of a Leiden register talking about Pearl. You did certain songs. There is a declamatory. Brett is talking to you now.
Yeah, I know. It's quite good in that. No, I like that style of singing. That was it called Sprang Sprang.
Yes.
Yeah, I love
Yard Act and Mark E. Smith and everybody.
Yeah, well, yeah. Mark E. Smith was the master, of course.
Matt, did you miss the roaring guitars and the sense of being in the middle of a battle when playing these songs?
This is a fantastic record for me to play on because it's basically just the five of us. You know, there's hardly any overdubs. There's no extra musicians or anything like that. There's parts of the Blue Owl where I think there's only really Neil on them for kind of like 2 or 3 minutes. You know what I mean? There's orchestral bits and then choirs and all this kind of stuff. Every few years, we have to kind of burn it all down and start again. I think it's good for your soul to kind of like get back to just those kind of really primal feelings of how it felt when you started, you know, just making a racket in a rehearsal room. You know, the first record we made was the songs that we had and that we'd honed playing live. And then when we made Coming Up, you know, it was basically the first 12 songs that Richard wrote. And I think we wanted to get that sense back again, just as that kind of like the noise of a gang mentality. It's always good for us.
So it's your third debut album.
Yeah, exactly. We're always saying this. It's a good gimmick. This, you know? We're going to keep making debut albums until we're kind of 80 or something.
I want to know, how punk were Young Suede in their youth, knocking around Haywards Heath? Did you have the spiked hair?
No, I mean, the weird thing is that we really kind of weren't particularly at all, were we? I was kind of gothy and Brett was kind of quite suave, you know what I mean? Yeah. He wore hats and stuff.
What kind of hats? I need to know this.
But I only met you when I was sort of 17. Before that, I'd sort of been through a punk phase, and I'd been through the kind of the crass phase and cutting my own hair phase and stuff like that. And then the punkest thing I could think of doing after that was sort of like get a kind of lemon yellow suit from Top Man for about 15 quid. I thought it was the height of sophistication. So you just met me on a phase, yeah. But it was all kind of like, you know, we didn't have the money to look like proper punks, bizarrely enough. You know what I mean? It's got some sort of red skiing jacket and a Nagasaki Nightmare patch on it. And the haircut that made me look like a laboratory rat, you know what I mean? I remember once sticking my head in a bucket of bleach because I thought, you know, you think, well, bleach bleaches your hair. And it's like household, it's like Harpic or something like that. Didn't yes, work.
Not that kind of bleach.
No.
From the last few records, one of the tracks that stood out, you thought was the best song you'd ever written up to that point, is a song called Life is Golden, which is a completely guileless song. No irony, no sort of darkness to it, just a real song of beauty and encouragement. Do you think you're becoming non-ironic and perhaps more open in your worldview as you get into your mature years?
Well, I hope not. I don't want to be too earnest and become an earnest bore. But sometimes there are moments, you know, in life that are just genuinely beautiful. That was a song that I wrote for my son. And so in a way, it's a companion piece to She Still Leaves Me On, because Life is Golden is a song written from the parent to the child. And She Still Leaves Me On is a song written from the child to the parent. So I think of them as almost like kind of brethren. I'm kind of proud of both of the songs. But yeah, I think sometimes earnestness can be all right.
It's quite a nice arc, though, isn't it, to go from life is sleazy and disgusting and horrible in your youth to, you know, as you get older, actually, it's beautiful and lovely and wonderful.
Yeah, but again, when I'm writing about family now, I, the last thing I want to do is sort of like romanticise it. You know, I always try and look for the kind of the anxiety and the darkness and these sorts of things. I think it's okay to be a parent or a husband or whatever that doesn't bring the darkness into your life. But as an artist, I think it's important to find those murkier points. And so the last album, The Blue Hour, was very much about the kind of anxieties of parenthood. And I wanted to write about being a parent because that was it was an important state for me because it was new for me. But I didn't want to write about it from the kind of like, I'm going with my son to the zoo kind of, so, you know, with that kind of model going on, because that's just dull. Do you know what I mean? I'll leave that to people that used to be in boy bands.
You could make it interesting, all those animals.
Yeah.
Yeah, maybe the next record, you know.
Yeah, yeah, the beasts.
I'm looking for murkiness. You know, I think there's always friction. I think there's a tendency to believe that as artists drift into middle age, that they become comfortable and irrelevant. And I'm determined to not become comfortable and irrelevant.
This idea that people sort out their problems by the time they're 50, which is an utter lie. I sold that.
Yeah. I think problems just shift and become different problems. But, you know, I experienced just as much anxiety as I did as a teenager and in my 20s, even though my life seems from the outside relatively comfortable. There's always these thorny things to grapple with, you know?
Does he listen to suede music, your lad?
Well, he does when I'm in the car, Andrew.
What does he think?
He likes Black Rebel Motorcycle Club at the moment. So he likes Black Sabbath and he likes Motorhead. So, but he does. I tell you what, this is an interesting thing. So my son is often the first person to ever hear suede songs. Yeah, because what I do is I spend all day taking to school, and then I'd spend all day writing. And at the end of the day, I kind of like, you know, blah, blah, blah. And then we go out for a bath and I'll just sort of like play it to him, right? Because it's really interesting to get a child's perspective on a record, because they haven't come freighted with all this sort of like this baggage about whether it sounds like fucking Velvet Underground or something like that. They just appreciate it on a really primal level. And so in a funny sort of way, he was quite an inspiration for this, because I was playing him things like Black Eyes. And he was going, yeah, Dad, that's brilliant. I love that. I love that. And I'd play him something else that didn't make the record. And he'd go, nah, I don't like that so much. So he was a kind of filter in a funny sort of way, you know.
A lot of autofiction, which Andrew and I, we have to say, we have been hammering it all week.
We
absolutely can't get it off the stereo at the moment. But a lot of it for me seems to be from a female perspective, and you are comfortable or you enjoy writing from a female perspective. Shadow Self in particular, I have been dancing in the kitchen to. But is this just another side of you? Is it a way of getting in some sort of characterisation if you put it in a female viewpoint?
Well, I've always sort of shifted perspectives. I think that's an interesting thing to do. It kind of keeps it fresh sometimes. You know, lots of my early sort of ballads are kind of from my mum's perspective. I was always inspired. There's a song, brilliant song by Bob Dylan called North Country Blues, where he sort of inhabits the mind of a Victorian female farmer. And I always thought that was a brilliant song. I was just quite inspired by that. I think it's okay to shift perspective. I think people are slightly suspicious of it with rock writers. It's almost like the preserve of novelists, isn't it?
Matt, I mean, I always liked the get down with your lower self side of suede. You know, can't get enough an Elephant Man, you know, the kind of shake your brain aspect. And there is a great properly Neanderthal final track called Turn Off Your Brain and Yell, which is both higher self and lower self in the same song, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, that was the very last thing we did for the record. The record was actually, we thought the record was finished. Brett and Richard came with that, ready for the next record. We were already like talking about the next thing. And it was such a kind of summation of everything we'd done up until that point that it felt like the end of that one rather than the start of something new. And I do think it's probably, we couldn't have started the album with something like that. Something that was that kind of straightforward and such big gaps in terms of it's all music for the first kind of like minute and a half or something like that. Yeah, I think it's a summation of the rest of the album. It would have been a weirdly different record, actually, if it had had the original last track on.
Let's have another track from Autofiction. This is 15 again. Tell us about this. Again, we are back to our youth and our teenage years.
Yeah, I mean, this is probably the sort of lightest thing on the record, and in one sense, you know, it's supposed to be quite carefree, deliberately. So it's just about, you know, it's supposed to be like a modernized "You Make Me Feel So Young," that kind of thing. It's like that. It's like the Frank Sinatra song. It's the same. It's like a 2022 version of that.
Well, if Frank Sinatra was a delinquent heavy metal teenager, he would perform
from Hayward's Heath.
From Hayward's Heath, he'd perform 15 again. Let's have a listen.
He would in his kitten heels.
In bedrooms with TV bills.
Matt, Suede are a band with a lot of sidelines. Everybody's always making films and having other bands and, you know, little side projects here and there. Brett's written two autobiographies, and we had you on the podcast last year with your novel, The Ruins, which is really good and a fantastic read. We're surprised at how well received it was, because I know you said you kind of like, I'm just going to do it to see if I can do it. And actually, it went down fantastically well.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny. It's one of those things that at first I thought, oh, everyone would love the idea that you know, a kind of a musician writing a book. And then an author friend of mine said, well, how do you feel about actors who start bands? I was kind of like, oh, God. And he sort of, well, basically, that's what you are. To us writers, you're Johnny Depp. I kind of love doing it. You know, it's so different from music. The funny thing is, having spent the last 2 years writing another novel, it does drive you a bit mental, though. You know, I see why authors drink, because they spend all day in their own heads. It was such a relief getting into the studio and doing the Suede record and just having immediate feedback in every sense. Building something really quickly and kind of like being able to be a bit more kind of straightforward about how you work.
Well, The Ruins is a fantastically intricate book and like incredibly plotted, full of loads of themes. It is essentially a Dogman Star of a novel. Maybe you should just try an auto fiction of a novel and just bang it out.
That's a really good idea, actually. Yeah, that's good. Yeah, I could just do it. I'm not sure what a kind of auto fiction novel would be. It'd be a novella, maybe. An incredibly violent novella. I feel like you've just given me homework, actually. That's a great idea.
You missed a golden moment in book promotion when the last time I ran into Brett was in Kensington and we were on the other side of the road waving at each other, and I was waving my copy of your book at him going, this is great, isn't it? And Brett produced from his bag his copy of your book and went, yes, it's great. And
passers by was the thought, couldn't it?
Yeah, we thought it was like an advert, just like get random people to wander around town waving your book and they're going, this is really good, you should read it. You know, the motivation.
That's actually, yeah, I mean, proper word of mouth. Get everyone on the tube kind of going, oh, you're reading it too.
Yeah, it was kind of shout of mouth more than anything. Yeah, yeah. Now, I want to ask you, are you and your brother Richard competitive on the writing front? You know, you've written a book, oh God, I'm going to do one now.
Hopefully not, seeing as he sold a million copies in kind of 6 months.
What makes the Osmonds such a creative bunch?
God knows, because, I mean, no one in our family is at all. You know what I mean? My grandfather was a policeman. My parents were a teacher and a businessman. I mean, we didn't really have records at home. My mum reads a lot. But God knows. I think just a desire to show off. I keep trying to think that it might be something, you know, deeper than that. But the fact that we both kind of appear in public a lot I think it's just that.
So the same impulse that drives a band, essentially.
I think so. Yeah. You know, I mean, it changes though, doesn't it? I think, you know, when you start a band to be heard and to kind of for people to look at you and people to be interested in you. You know what I mean? It's just a way of getting attention as much as anything else. And it's only when you get older and you've done a few albums that it shifts, and what's important is that you reach people and that you move people. You know, I think most people start it from selfish motives and end up doing it for more kind of altruistic motives. You know, nowadays the things that I love is when I hear someone whose life has been soundtracked by what we've done. You know, people who get married to our music or had their first kiss to our music. You know, that kind of privilege of being woven into other people's lives is an incredible thing. But that's not why I started doing that. You know, I wasn't that deep a person at all.
Yeah, that came later.
When people go and see Suede, we were astounded, and the crowd, as you know, your glorious crowd, who are just super fanatic, sort of feed off your energy, you feed off them. Are you surprised sometimes by how much you end up flinging yourself on stage and around? Does something take over you when you're performing live?
Oh, God, yeah. No, yeah, no, absolutely. It takes me over. The persona takes me over, definitely. But I've always sort of loved the sort of tactile thing about being on stage. I've always loved contact with the audience. I've always loved that ritualistic sort of Dionysian frenzy that you get at a good gig, you know, and contact with the audience and the loop of response with the audience is such a key part for me. We've never been one of those bands that can just sort of stand there and play exactly like we would in a rehearsal room. I've never really understood the point of that. And I've never really understood audiences that don't understand that they're part of that response loop as well. You know, when you go to a gig, it's so different from going to the cinema. If you go to the cinema, it doesn't matter if you riot and tear up the seats, the film's going to be always the same. Yeah. When you're an audience member, you've got a role. You're like the 12th man in football. Do you know what I mean? You've got a role to, you know, and you can kind of influence how the band play. And I love that loop. I love that. And as I get sort of older as a performer, as I kind of get deeper into it as a performer, I kind of play on that more and I'm much more aware of it. I hate when we play big festivals in, I don't know, Europe or whatever. And there's like a huge pit, this huge gap, chasm between the band and the audience. It's like, oh, fuck off. You know what I mean? I want to get to the front row. I want to touch them. And, you know, it's very important for me, you know.
You know, you mentioned that you'd sort of missed Brett from Suede when it was lockdown. Is it difficult to turn Brett from Suede off after a performance or after those sorts of things? And how do you do that?
There's a sort of little weird sort of window of where it's like kind of you can't, if you're a diver, you can't come up to the surface too quickly sort of thing. You need like 20 minutes to decompress sort of thing. But yeah, I mean, Brett from Suede and me are two very different people now. And increasingly as I get older, they separate further and further, which is kind of the way it should be, really. If I was still kind of Brett from Suede when I was doing the school run, I'd be faintly ridiculous. But I like to think that I've evolved a bit as a person in the last 30 years, but maybe not.
Yeah. I like the idea of Brett from Suede on the school run, just flinging himself out of the car, standing on top, going, "Have you got your dinner stuff?
I've gotten your apple.
I can't hear you.
You've got to do it. At one point, you've got to do it.
This is like, this would be a Reeves and Mortimer sketch.
I'm just going to go and slap in my ass. I'm just going to go and slap in my bum with a microphone, you know.
Yeah.
Weirdly, today, someone's just put a 25-year-old Melody Maker interview I did with you, Brett, up on Twitter. You promised in it, because I had a quick read, a recipe for gazpacho soup, which I never got.
Oh, sorry about that.
Do you still make it?
I haven't made it for a while. I made it a few years ago. But yeah, I think I've lost the recipe. But gazpacho is still one of my favourite things. I love a good bit of gazpacho. Yeah. I do the one in Waitrose. Can't remember what it's called. Avel.
Yes,
like
I get that. It's on offer at the moment as well. Yeah, so I'm stocking up because that's the really good one. Sorry, Andy, you just had you're looking at me. But this is more important.
This is a demonic rock and roll inside stories that we need. As I mentioned earlier, you two have known each other since you were teenagers. You were the core of the original Suede. We've just passed the 30th anniversary of The Drowners coming out back in 1992. What do you think that Brett then and Matt then would think of how Suede's career has played out?
I mean, we never really looked that far ahead. I think you'd be very strange if you did at kind of 23. I think I'd be really proud of the records. You know what I mean? I think there's a thread running through them that means that my kind of like 25-year-old self would have recognised them and would have recognised the kind of the drama of them and the passion of them. I'm quite surprised that you make a kind of career of it. You know, it never really felt like it. It really felt like a kind of act of revenge rather than anything else. So the idea of kind of it being day-to-day, I think, would be very strange. But I think I'd still like the records. I'm pretty sure of that.
I don't think you ever feel as though you've arrived, actually. You always feel like you're kind of in the process of getting somewhere or heading towards somewhere, but you never feel I'm successful or I'm part of the music industry. It's really odd. It's that sort of way in which I see our career as being flawed that keeps us going. I always look back at what we've done with a kind of tinge of regret and feel as though we can do better next time. And that's possibly why we just started making our 10th album. Do you know what I mean?
Are you saying that when you look back upon your life, it's always with a sense of shame?
Exactly. That's exactly what I'm saying.
What's your favourite Suede song to perform, both of you?
Oh, God, that's a really, really good question. I really like playing Can't Get Enough. That's always amazing. I quite like He's Dead, actually. I always like it when that one turns up in the set list because you get kind of completely lost in it. There's something really kind of all-encompassing about it.
I love any song that the audience sort of sings back at you. So, you know, that can be trash or something, or it can be The other day we did a gig in Norway, we did a festival, and we played an acoustic version of She's in Fashion, and that kind of went, it was beautiful. The whole, you know, there was sort of like 10,000 people sort of singing the song back at us, and that's really lovely. I mean, music, that's why people love live music. It's a group activity, isn't it? It's the word atavistic, where it kind of like relating to when you're, you know, your ancestry or something like that.
Yeah, getting back to your lower self.
Yeah, yeah, it's a congregation, isn't it? It's a congregation of something, of an energy, I always think, that's neither mind nor body, but just goes into something else.
Yeah, and that's why we have kind of, you know, sort of rituals and chanting, all these sorts of things. I love it when we're playing live and the audience is engaged and singing back to me. And that can happen with all sorts of songs. It tends to happen with Beautiful Ones and Trash and Animal Nitrate and things like that. But it can happen with slow songs as well. And sometimes I do... you know, like acoustic songs, like very, I like, for me, live music is all about extremes. It's all about being fucking unbelievably loud or incredibly quiet. Yeah. It's all about the drama, about the dynamic between those two states. And I like being really quiet and off mic as well sometimes, you know.
Brett, have you forgiven Andrew for putting you on the front of Select magazine with a Union Jack in the background?
Oh, yes. Can we have a little cuddle, Andrew?
I am absolved. The guilt is gone.
You, I was worried.
It's okay. I don't hold grudges.
I don't think any of us knew what was going to happen after that.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
No. Well, I've been personally blamed for Brexit for doing that, so I guess it's all my own fault, really.
Oh, yeah, don't worry, it's water under the bridge.
It is water under the bridge. Now, every week we ask our guests to bring in a current favourite track of theirs as a service to the listeners. Brett and Matt, you've each chosen a track. Brett, what track have you chosen?
I chose the dry cleaning track, Scratch Card Lanyard. I was just sort of bowled over when I first heard this. I don't know why. There was just something so incredibly, sort of shockingly original about it. I absolutely loved it. And the wordplay in it is kind of genius. It's kind of, it manages to walk this tightrope between sort of strangely profound and really funny, which is a really virtually impossible tightrope to walk. I've never been able to do it.
And Matt, how about you?
I chose this track, which is Daniel Luppi and Greg Gonzalez. Greg Gonzalez is the singer from Cigarettes After Sex, who I think are the band so many people don't listen to just because they hate the name so much. But I've always, always really loved his voice. I think it's an amazing voice. It's very, you can't tell if he's a man or a woman. It's really kind of, it's quite haunting. And he's done this track with Daniel Luppi. I don't know if you know him. He's an Italian film composer who's done these three amazing albums, which are kind of like homages to Italian film music of the 50s and 60s and 70s. And the middle one, Roma, is amazing. It's really, really beautiful. It's kind of like Virgin Suicides era air, that kind of thing. And the two of them together, it's just this really sweeping cinematic. It's beautiful.
Well, we're going to put them both on the playlist, and here's an excerpt now.
As a special extra, we've also asked Matt and Brett to choose a current favourite album. We'll add a couple of tracks to the playlist too. So, Matt, what album have you gone for?
I've gone for the new record by the Mars Volta, which is called The Mars Volta. And it's so strange. I've never particularly liked them. They're kind of like really kind of clever, Zappa-esque, lots of proggy things in there. And they're always one of these bands that I like 30 seconds of the track, and then it goes off on some weird thing. They released the first single from this is a track called Black Light Shine, which is absolutely amazing. It's a kind of Latin pop thing. It's very poppy. There's an amazing video for anyone searching online, which is 10 minutes long. The last 7 minutes are just drums. It's this Puerto Rican bomba drum group. It's beautiful. It's absolutely great. But the rest of the record is incredible. It's a It's really poppy. It's kind of R&B sounding. Lots of Latin influences, obviously, because they're both Puerto Rican. But it was such a pleasant surprise. You know, they came back after like 7 years, and it's easily the best thing they've done, which is great.
Brett, what album have you chosen?
Oh, you're going to like this, because I heard about this on the Culture Bunker, in fact.
Hooray!
There you go. Listen to the Culture Bunker. No, it's Working Men's Club.
Why would you be doing that?
Yeah, it's Working Men's Club. And I kind of liked their first album. Liked it. Didn't sort of absolutely love it. But great, you know, not bad at all. But then I sort of heard you guys talking about, I can't remember who's talking about, someone was talking about on your show. And I went to listen to it. It's called Fear. And I just love it. It's dark electro, gothy electro sort of stuff. I think it's just kind of like it's sort of like I kind of interpreted it as a kind of lockdown album. It's sort of desperate and claustrophobic, and it's just brilliant. You know, it kind of just disappears off into these kind of like weird sort of drum machine-y grooves and sort of odd guitar solos and stuff. But some of the melodies are brilliant. I love his voice. I love the way where his voice sort of sits. It kind of like he does the sort of talking, singing thing really well.
Mm-hmm. And he's still 20 years old.
Yeah, very talented. Yeah,
absolutely. Yeah, we gave it a massive rave review on here. I love it.
No, I heard, and that it kind of made me go and listen to it, and I kind of checked it, and I was, you know, that's good. And then I go, oh, yeah, this is great, you know, so... I was bopping around my kitchen to it one night, yeah.
Fantastic. Good. That's a good recommendation. This is Cut.
House of the Dragon is probably the most hotly anticipated ever TV prequel, at least among my circle of geeks. Not since season 3 of Succession have I been more curious about a thing. And interestingly, House of the Dragon is all about succession. Set roughly 2 centuries before Game of Thrones, it charts the fall from power of the Targaryen dynasty, Daenerys' ancestors, the very family who united the realms using the might of dragons. 2 episodes have screened already on Sky Atlantic. Let's sample a little amuse-bouche.
The dream. It was clearer than a memory. And I heard the sound of thundering hooves, splintering shields and ringing swords. And I placed my heir upon the Iron Throne. And all the dragons roared as one.
I consider the matter urgent. That of your succession.
Well, who else would have a claim?
The firstborn child.
Rhaenyra. No queen has ever sat the Iron Throne.
The king has an heir. Daemon Targaryen.
I will not be made to choose between my brother and my daughter.
Rhaenyra's succession will be challenged. Knives will come out.
You are the king. Your duty is to take a new wife.
I have decided to name a new heir. I'm your heir.
War is afoot.
Sean, were you a fan of the original? Is this something you looked forward to?
I'm afraid I'm going to have to rain on the parade fairly early in that I have watched the first few episodes of the first season of Game of Thrones and I kind of stopped there because dragons. Alex, you're going to really have to sell this to me. So I come to this very much knowing it's a prequel, but not really knowing what it's a prequel to. And I hope that I do stand for some of our listeners who didn't quite get it. Will I get it this time?
I hope you do get it. I mean, as a big, big fan of the original mm-hmm. series, I would suggest that you give it another go because I mean, I don't know if Andrea agrees or not, but my sense is that after the first series, it really becomes much less about dragons and much more about court politics. And that's the really sort of juicy and fun bit of it. So, I mean, the general setting is now familiar. There are a lot of characters for the first few episodes to establish. Was the story easy to follow? Did it grab you, at least better than the first?
I think the answer to that is yes, actually, yeah. They've laid it out. They have laid it out for people like me who might not have seen the first few seasons. There is an awful lot of, well, I am obviously this sort of person and I'm obviously that sort of person in the dialogue. But then it gets into, starts getting into the gore. And that's when I started to enjoy it. So there's incredible scenes. If we're talking jousting, which we are because it's that kind of show, this is jousting proper. Yeah. This is where, if you get thrown off your horse by a really big stick, your head might fall off and all the blood will come out. And they do this amazing, I mean, not to give anything away, but someone gives birth and they juxtapose giving birth in long ago times with jousting, and there's the same amount.
Because that is woman's
blood.
Battle. That is woman's battle.
But I actually thought that was done absolutely brilliant. And that's the point where it clicked for me. And I thought, oh, I can start to see why people enjoy this.
Hmm.
Because this is where
I
it does
to
get
say
interesting.
That was this scene. Yeah, that was the scene where I started to think they're filmmakers. It's not just the soap. They have stuff to say. One of the characters says, "I'm glad I'm not a woman." I think that could be the subtitle to the entire thing. Women are explicitly used as sort of alliance chips and royal breeding machines, but there is a sense of rebellion against that, especially by the central character, Princess Rhaenyra, played by Millie Alcock. I think she's wonderful. Is the result, do you think, an anthem to misogyny, as the first, you know, Game of Thrones was sometimes accused of being, or is it an anthem to the strong women battling it?
I think it's a good question because often, because I'm a deeply pretentious soul, I watch things and think, whose story is this? And usually there is a main character whose story it is, or sometimes it is the group. But it's very much her story, the first couple of episodes which I've seen. This is about her battle. It's seen from her point of view. And there are lots of men pontificating and lots of men, you know, telling each other how terribly important they are and then showing acts of that. But you are seeing it through her eyes and you're seeing the injustice, but also the future and what she can do. And in that, I found that really interesting. And again, as you say, that starts to take it away from soap opera into something else that's far more interesting about the psychology, about how you lead and how you lead as a woman. So I started enjoying that.
Andrew, the thing that distinguished the original Game of Thrones, I think, more than anything else, was the sense that it was pushing at the limits of what is television and what is cinematic. Does House of the Dragon maintain that epic scope, or do they reel it back?
I think the epic scope is now a built-in expected hygiene factor in shows as big ticket as this. What it did make me think is I remember watching Game of Thrones when it came out and the slow burn way in which it revealed itself. We tend to forget that you don't realize until the end of season one of Game of Thrones that magic is a thing in this world. The first season is very much horses and jousting and swords, and on the fringes is something supernatural. The world doesn't really open up until the second and third series, and what you're seeing is television stretching its legs and spreading its wings. You begin to see grand, incredible spectacle bit by bit by bit as the show develops. On this one, you're right in feet first. We are straight in. Dragons are an ever-present thing. This huge sprawl of King's Landing, incredible architecture, all of it digital. So there's no sort of slow burn build-up here because you can't do that again. You cannot repeat the sense that you are sort of slowly unpeeling the layers of this world and finding out the insanity within. That said, I think they use it phenomenally well. It does look sumptuous, beautiful, and most importantly, fully credible.
But ultimately, I think what keeps this sort of fantasy series interesting is not the CGI dragons, it's not the battle scenes, splendid though they are. It is the politics, it is the dialogue, it is the performances. Is House building a sort of similar gallery of rogues, some lovable and some deliciously hateable, like Cersei and people like that?
What I liked about it is that the kind of message behind the message behind the message is that history doesn't repeat, but it does rhyme. And sometimes it prepeats because this is 200 years before. So what we see is, the core characters are Paddy Considine as King Viserys Targaryen, who is a weak king trying to be a strong king, fundamentally a decent man with terrible failings that mean that perhaps he's not well suited to ruling Westeros at all. His daughter, Princess Rhaenyra, we've talked about, she's great, but there is an element in her of the flint and the ambition and the coldness that later we see in Daenerys, which turns Daenerys into a monster. Obviously, being a Doctor Who partisan, I am very here for Matt Smith as Prince Daemon.
Yeah. Who is...
Now, having seen him in this and some of his post-Doctor Who work, I realise he is actually much better at playing a villain than he is at playing a hero. Yeah. And in a sense, he very nearly played the Doctor as a villain. There was a bit of naughtiness about him. Prince Daemon is an absolute bastard in this, entirely driven by ambition, entirely driven by self, entirely driven by a burning sense of kind of malignant need for status, but also driven, frankly, by impotence, because there's a hell of a lot of talk about fathering heirs here, and Prince Daemon just seems to have a bit of a problem with just reaching the final yard of the race, as it
That's
were.
Interesting.
Also, a bit of a shout to Rhys Ifans as Otto Hightower, who is he's the Hand of the King. We've seen people who've been the Hand of the King before. We see in him many of the characteristics that will be echoed in later people in that position. Extremely cold, extremely distant, extremely Machiavellian.
And he's good, isn't he? Because I almost didn't recognise him. I thought, that's Rhys Ifans. I thought, no, of course it's not. But I think this is one of the roles of his life, actually, that he's come out of the comedy geek.
A lot of women in the writing room. And the episodes are shared between two male and two female directors, including Claire Kilner, who directs The Alienist, which I don't know if you know, I absolutely love that series. So her name in there was a big sort of kite mark of quality for me. I started quite unsure, Sian, because, you know, having the fondness that I have for the original, you're always apprehensive that they're just going to ruin everything. I think by episode 3 and 4, I was profoundly in love with it, actually. It's very similar but fundamentally different as well, in a weird way. They use a really different color palette and photography for scenes inside the palaces and the gardens and scenes of what's going on outside, you know, with a hoi polloi. And when there is a moment when the princess actually leaves the palace and goes out in the city, and the clash of those, you know, that beautiful pastel, rosy life and the grit and dirt of the outside is absolutely wonderful. I thought the dialogue was incredibly different to the original, to the point that I think for the first half hour, it grated with me because I really loved the dialogue of the original. It was modern, you know, it was Mamet, basically, even though it was in a medieval setting. The dialogue in this is a lot more Jane Austen-esque, a lot, you know, a lot more polite and roundabout and florid and Shakespearean at times. And then as it went on, I realized it was a conscious choice, because the world we see in Game of Thrones is a world where the aristocracy has basically been overthrown and there's clans feuding for power, while this is firmly in an era where the aristocracy is absolutely Marie Antoinette-ing it. I think it was a conscious choice. And once that clicked in my head, I began to really love it. And once again, you started to see bits outside of the palace, you began to realize that people outside the palace are actually direct and gruff, like they were in Game of Thrones. It's only inside the palace where it's all a lot of panel stitching and sort of polite ways of being bitchy.
The key aspect of Game of Thrones is that you're effectively watching a turning point in history for two reasons. One is, how is Westeros going to be ruled and under what system is it going to be ruled? And then, of course, let's not forget there's a giant army of zombies that's going to come and kill off humanity. That old thing. With House of the Dragon, I don't yet get the same sense that you're looking at a turning point in history. You're not looking at a hinge in history. What you're looking at is people playing out the rules and the mores of this moment in history. That said, I'm only 4 episodes in, and I'm not entirely sure, you know, how it's heading. At the moment, we're looking at, will Dreadful Prince Daemon get his way? But there are other things lurking around the edges which may begin the sort of slow downfall of the hereditary monarchy, which brings us to the place that we're in Game of Thrones, where, as you say, it's all up in the air and it's all to play for.
The disease, physical and mental, that comes from inbreeding, that's really heavily peppered in there. Effectively, it's basically setting up instead of the different houses, you know, that battled it out in Game of Thrones, it's setting up the different branches of the Targaryen family that I suspect are going to end up battling it in this. I was quite taken with it. A mixture of relief that they didn't sort of ruin it, and relief that it's not the same. It is very different. It has its own identity, but it's also very simpatico to the thing that I love.
It's going
to
do well, isn't it?
Yeah, big thumbs, big thumbs.
And I do not in any way mind this kind of criticism that apparently, well, we know what's going to happen, so what's the point? No, we don't know what's going to happen, but more importantly, we don't know how it's going to happen.
Well, I was going to say, it's all about the how, isn't it, TV
yeah,
now?
And you know, how's it going to happen? Why is it going to happen? Who's it going to happen to? Mm. We know that by the time Game of Thrones begins, there's, you know, what is it, two Targaryens left? What is going to be the route that takes us there?
Yeah.
And who's going to actuate that? I suspect Prince Daemon is going to turn out to be the agent of the destruction of his own house and an entire world. Who
could
knows?
Could look likely.
Looks a bit that way, I would suggest.
And on to TV. Lord of the Rings, that little-known media franchise, rears one of its many heads as the Rings of Power, no sniggering in the back, prequel, launches on Amazon this weekend. Starring Moffat Clark, Robert Aramayo and Sir Lenny Henry, yes, has the reported £739 million they splurged on this season been well spent? Elfin ears? Tick. Wizards? Tick. Cast of thousands? Tick. Huge scenes in a massive water pool and prosthetic noses? Tick. Alex and I went along to see the first two episodes. Do we know our Middle Earth so well, or will we give it the middle finger? And does it matter? We'll chat after the trailer.
I am not the hero you seek.
Whatever it was you did, be free of it.
One day this will be your kingdom.
Raise your sail and then let go.
Choose not the path of fear, but that of faith.
One thing we can do, better than any creature in all Middle Earth, we stay true to each other with our hearts even bigger than our feet.
We can survive this, you and I.
Commander! Wait!
No! We keep moving!
Why do you keep fighting?
There is a tempest in me.
You have fought long enough, Galadriel. Put up your sword.
Without it, what am I to be?
Alex, first off, are you a Tolkien nut?
I'm not a Tolkien nut. I mean, there are people who are proper, like, Tolkien academics.
Mm-hmm.
I've basically read all the books once, Lord of the Rings twice, and I've seen the six films that Peter Jackson put out there. And I think I may have seen the animated series that was knocking about in the 80s.
That is quite a lot, though, to a layperson.
Well, I mean,
I feel that is a lot.
Well, look, I mean, the person who was teaching me English in Greek was a Tolkien nut.
Mm-hmm.
So they were part of our sort of reading list. And also, when I was a teenager and probably too late into my 20s, I was a very avid tabletop role-playing person. So,
okay.
You know, Advanced Dungeons and Dragons and that sort of thing. And all of it is basically based on Tolkien. You know, the different classes that are described that your character can be, the different professions, the different attributes they have, the way they go up levels, everything is based around this world of Middle-earth. Mm-hmm. So I have a good knowledge of it, as it were, but I'm not. So if you asked me what are the differences between what we watched and the books, I couldn't tell you. But I understand the environment and the language quite well, if that makes sense.
Yes, and this also means presumably you have something invested. You want to see something good come out of this because you've obviously put in the hours previously. Why do you think that Amazon are making a prequel, which is the obvious question, but it is why? And do the characters chime with what we later see in the Lord of the Rings trilogy?
So I think the reason they're making a prequel is because they want to, first of all, because these stories haven't been told before. So what happened was Tolkien wrote The Hobbit, and then because that was so hugely successful, his publisher asked him for a sequel. And he went to his publisher with, if I remember correctly, The Tales of the Silmarillion, which ended up only being published posthumously. Because his editor rejected it. He thought it was too niche, too Celtic, too mythological, basically, and didn't have enough of a narrative spine. And so Tolkien went away and came back with The Lord of the Rings. And there are also some unfinished stories that were published posthumously. A lot of this comes, yes, from The Lord of the Rings, yes, from The Hobbit, but the mythology, as it were, the origin stories of all the people that we see later on come from places like the Silmarillion and his unfinished tales. So to me, it was quite natural to make a prequel because it is stuff that no one has seen on screen before.
Right. Okay.
But also teasing the stuff that we know. So we see a man fall from the stars, who is very confused and can't speak human tongue yet and things like that. And fans of the genre will know that this develops into a much beloved character later on. So it was a good compromise. I think it's the right choice.
So first off, we see through the eyes of Galadriel, who is played by Mufford Clark. She is sort of our entry into this whole thing. She's given her mission, so to speak, when her brother dies. Does that make sense? And is she in any of those previous books? Because obviously I am someone who does need educating this. This is not my ballpark.
Yes, so unlike some characters that Peter Jackson invented that were amalgamations of different people in the books, and that was because effectively The Hobbit and The Lord of the Rings have an almost total lack of female characters. And so in order to give the story a more balanced dynamic, Peter Jackson took a lot of smaller female characters and amalgamated them into slightly larger one, and at times even invented characters. Galadriel is someone who exists in the Middle Earth mythology and is a really quite a central character. In the books, she's more the queen of the elves and really quite a terrifying, but also quite a benevolent creature. She has sort of both sides to her. In this, because we're seeing her at such an early stage, before she's achieved her full status, before experience has made her cynical, she's quite a different character. She's effectively a young Valkyrie, I thought. Really a warrior princess that goes out there to do her quest and prove her mettle. I thought she was stunning, by the way. I thought one of the best things about the early part of the first episode was her narration, because there is a lot of stuff to go through. There's a lot of exposition to go through. And I thought she did it in a way that made it magical and non-intrusive. So big credit to her. It's interesting. Do you remember I kept telling you, I kept elbowing you and going, she really looks like Rebecca Ferguson. Yes, you remember that?
Yes, yeah.
So they're both Swedish born.
Oh, okay. Isn't I was going to say her thing? Face is absolutely captivating. She is well cast. She doesn't need a lot of dialogue or anything because you are just watching how she's interacting and reacting to everything else. In that sense, she's really good to lead us into what is very complicated. There are lots of interweaving stories here. We don't know. Well, I don't know how they're going to intertwine at some point. What other characters stood out for you?
We've only seen two episodes, haven't we?
Yeah.
And so they were basically trying to begin all the different threads that will intertwine, and we didn't get very much development of all the characters, as it were. There are the humans. The healer of those stands out, in my view. There's it's a sort of female character, a mother. She owns the apothecary, basically.
She is Bronwyn. She's played by Nazanin Punjabi.
Yeah, Bronwyn, that's right. Yeah. Very good. I thought she stood out.
She's fantastic,
as a really strong character.
Yeah.
And Ismael Cruz Cordova plays the elf that is sort of in love with her, even though interspecies love is sort of forbidden.
Yes.
And and he's unfathomably hot.
you rather liked him, didn't you?
Yes,
you're intrigued how the story develops.
I'm all for interspecies love.
And why not?
but also, you know, it's a nice solid basis for that particular arc of the story, isn't it? You know, two people who are profoundly in love with each other but can't be with each other is always a compelling story. You know, I enjoyed that. I really enjoyed the world of the dwarves,
who are Scottish. Are they Scottish in the
yes, I mean,
is this a
thing? We'll come to the bum notes in a minute, because that was a real bum note for me. There was something that stood out for me. So one of the elven lords, who is friends with the Prince of the Dwarves, gave him a sapling many, many years before. And when he goes to his house, he finds that he's planted the sapling, and the sapling is doing really well, even though the dwarves live underground. And so it's a mystery why this tree keeps growing. And it is revealed that the tree doesn't need light to grow, but it needs love to grow. And this is a household with a lot of love. And I got a little bit choked up at that point.
Because there's a lovely
actually, that whole encounter with...
So Prince Durin is who you're talking about. He's married to Princess Disa. And they are the happy couple of the series. There is always one, isn't it? But there is something about their chemistry, isn't there? I just thought that she's fantastic.
She's magnificent, isn't she?
She's great. I wanted much more of her.
And as a little treat, at the end of the two episodes we saw at the screening, they gave us a teaser for the rest of the series. And it is quite clear that she features very heavily, which I'm really pleased about, because she's really engaging and it's a proper powerhouse performance. Early doors, I was incredibly impressed with what I saw. I mean, it's very much a put the money on the screen project, isn't it?
Absolutely.
In a good way.
I mean, I watched the budget, I felt, for the first 60 minutes because I didn't really quite know what was going on, and the elfin ears were getting on my nerves.
Yes, I mean, it is at times overwhelming to be exposed to this huge universe, but I just thought the cinematography was splendid, the artistic direction was out of this world. I thought I saw the influence of 3D printing, you know.
Okay.
There were times when I thought every piece of armor, every bit of furniture, every column, everything was carved so intricately, which is so important to the older worlds, like the elven worlds, you know, because they live for thousands and thousands of years. And I just thought that added real detail and depth and made everything look incredibly beautiful. The attention to detail is worth a second viewing on its own. I think this will please Tolkien fans a lot, and I think it will be a hit with audiences too.
Because fans
epic.
Will like it. Yeah,
it's epic. It just
it's fantasy, isn't it?
Along.
I was going to ask. I mean, we've had this huge rebirth of the fantasy genre. That is no underestimate, because we're also talking Game of Thrones, aren't we, as well? What was derided a few decades ago is really big bucks again. Are we also petrified of the real world that we need to seek this solace?
Yeah, I mean, to a certain extent, yes. There is definitely a resurgence of the fantasy genre. I'm not sure it ever really went away. because a resurgent would imply that, you know, 10 years ago it wasn't there. But certainly it's true to say that, you know, 20 years ago everyone was going on about reality TV.
Well, yes.
How cheap
yes.
it was to make and stuff like that.
And if people were playing Dungeons and Dragons, they weren't telling people about it. You know what I mean?
Yes.
Decades ago.
Mm. This has cost a packet. And I can't even begin to think what the intellectual rights would have cost. Presumably Amazon hopes to make that back over several series, because they will obviously spin this for several
yes.
Different series, telling the whole story, you know, into The Hobbit, into The Lord of the Rings.
Well, it's pencil cases by Christmas, isn't it? It's all that.
Yeah.
I mean, the original Hobbit trilogy earned apparently $2.914 billion on a combined $750 million budget. So it's not as if this has not recouped before. So that's what they're gunning for, aren't they? That we all do keep the interest. And I think that will be with the characters, as we're saying. Is this a cash-in, though?
So I think it's a tentpole for any respectable streaming service.
Mm-hmm.
So you have HBO and Sky going with House of the Dragon to expand the Game of Thrones universe, mm-hmm. which, you know, we're seeing now. We are seeing Disney's acquisition of Marvel was the key to its success. Mm-hmm. We are seeing The Sandman on Netflix, again, a lavish series in which millions have been spent.
And also Stranger Things is fantasy.
Stranger Things, that's true too.
Yeah,
that's true too. And so I think that, along with things like the Star Trek franchise,
mm-hmm.
Which has now gone to Paramount Plus, they are seen as the things that will attract the subscribers.
Yeah.
So the subscribers stay if you have a good catalog of content, but the subscribers will only make the initial decision to pay that money mm-hmm. if you have the series that they absolutely must watch.
Yes. Yeah.
And so I think that becomes the big marquee at the front of each of the streaming services.
I think you're right.
Saying,
yeah.
come in. This is what you'll be getting with us. So, yeah. So it's not a cash in, it's a sort of cachet in.
Do you
like
that?
Did you like that?
Very good. Will you be sticking with it, Alex?
Oh, completely. Oh, yeah. I thought it was absolutely brilliant. Yeah. I mean, there, you know, to be critical, there was a bum note, mm-hmm. just the unbearable Celticness of it all turned up to 11.
Yes.
You know, the warm Irish halflings, the gruff northern humans, the delicate posh elves, the curt but lovable Scottish dwarves.
We have to give props here, though, to Sir Lenny Henry's Irish accent, which is impeccable.
Great.
He's good,
it's
isn't
not
he?
Only impeccable, it's really idiomatic, isn't it?
Yeah,
he's lovely,
he's great. Yes, I agree. There was a lot of selling Celticness to Americans, I think, in this one. Celticness,
yeah,
obviously not
I mean,
being a word.
Yeah. It's what Komijarevsky used mm-hmm. to call a sort of early 20th century theatre critic. He used to call it chocolate box realism.
Yes.
You know, let's put a little bit of this and let's make the maid Cockney and let's make the farmer Northern. And, mm-hmm. you know, it's a sort of easy way to attain a quite sloshy palette of colors.
Yes, it's a shorthand for you know where you are with this, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah. And I think bolder choices could have been made to the usual Anglocentric stamp that could have allowed different cultural design and musical influences to the different cultures in Middle Earth. Having said that, I recognize that an American and probably any non-UK audience will lap this up,
mm-hmm.
and I can live with it. So mm-hmm. it's a small criticism of what is a magnificently sweeping epic. Will you be sticking with it?
I was just thinking that. If I can get the kid into it, yeah, maybe.
Oh, the kid will get into it.
You think so? You think of like the elves? I'll see. He hasn't seen it yet. Well, anyway, this is our recommendation. It is Lord of the Rings, Rings of Power, and it's out this weekend.
Finally, all regular listeners know we also ask our guests to bring in their favourite song of all time in the history of recorded music to add to our grand playlist. And why not? Matt, what have you chosen as the single greatest piece of music ever made in the history of history itself?
Well, with the usual caveat that it's an impossible question. And it will change every time. Grace Jones, Nightclubbing.
Grace Jones, Nightclubbing. Right.
It's for no other reason than there's never been a cooler sounding record. There's records that mean more to me, and there's records that are cleverer, and there are records that remind me of things. But in, just in terms of sound, I don't think anything's ever been cooler. And every time I put it on, I feel about 78% cooler than I was when I put my headphones on, which is useful for an old man.
I'm now thinking that Suede have spent their lives trying to dress like Grace Jones. Tall, thin, angular, loads of black.
Exactly, and a plaster over one eye.
It does have that quality of it sounds like it was made yesterday or tomorrow, no matter when you play it.
It's incredible sound. It's incredible sounding. I mean, I've tried to rip it off loads of times. Because you listen to it and you think it's really dong, dong, da-dong, dong, dong, dong. Must be able to copy that. But there's something in the chemistry of Sly and Robbie and her that just, you can't do it. If you try and copy it, it sounds mechanical and it sounds terrible. Yeah, it's just, it's got grace. You know, it's beautifully done.
Brett, how about you? What have you chosen?
Well, the problem with this question is that there's so little good music made within the last 60 years, you know. So little to choose from. What could you? There's a million songs, isn't there? I've chosen NYC by Interpol because I just love it. I don't know. I quite like the idea of choosing something that happened this century. It's an incredible song because it manages to be dirgy and uplifting at the same time. And I don't know how you do that. And again, I've tried to write dirgy things and they just sound dirgy. And I don't really know how they do it. And I love the guy's voice as well. I think he's one of the greatest sort of singers of the modern age, actually. There's so much resonance and emotion that he manages to project. It's just a beautiful song. And I love the fact that it's only two chords as well. I think it's two chords. I can look at music. There's another chord in there. I think it's just two chords over.
It's primarily two chords.
I think it's two chords, yeah. I think it's primarily two chords. Yeah. I'm not,
at
I'm
one not point, it was two chords.
I think it's two chords. Yeah. Well, when I play it, it's on two chords, right? Hey.
I think euphoric dirges might be what I'm looking for in music.
It's a euphoric dirge, but I find it very uplifting.
Well, we're putting both of them on the rolling playlist. The links, as you know, are in the show notes, and it's on Tidal as well at the moment. And in case you don't know it, in the unlikely event, here's a bit of Brett's choice. This is NYC by Interpol.
And that's the end of the podcast. Thanks so much for joining us, Brett Anderson.
Thank you so much. Lovely to be here.
And Matt Osman.
Thank you for having me.
It's been a pleasure. Autofiction is bloody brilliant and it's out on September the 16th. So get your orders in early. There's probably exciting vinyl and things like that you can
tap into.
All sorts.
There's a variety of formats in which you can purchase.
And for the first time ever, it's got a picture of Brett on the front. Hasn't it? You've never been on the front of your own record before.
That's absolutely true. Yeah, there's a couple of firsts. It's got the picture of me on the front, and it's the first album we've ever made that doesn't end with a ballad. But whatever, that's just for suede heads, I suppose.
So remember, listeners, you can get all the tunes on our rolling playlist. The link is at the top of the show notes.
And you can support The Bunker on Patreon to get daily episodes on politics, science and culture all early and ad-free. Search Patreon Bunker Podcast to find out how. From me, Andrew and Sean, and producers Alex Rees and Yelena Sofronievich, thank you for listening. We'll see you next week.
The Culture Bunker was produced and presented by Andrew Harrison, Sean Pattenden, and Alex Andreu. The producers were Yelena Sofronievich and me, Alex Rees, with assistant production from Kasia Tomasiewicz. Music by Kenny Dickinson. The Culture Bunker is a Podmasters production.